I don't know if what I did at the end of 2018 would now work in 2022. Like, I still think content and storytelling is key, but the form and format that you do it in, I think has totally changed.
Oh my God. I'm not sure if you have like a Pantone book, but we recently bought a Pantone book out of necessity because every single batch was a different shade of pink.
Oh, we've gone through that.
Yeah, and I didn't realize it until people put it side by side and said, hey, it's like off. But yeah, no, there's a number of mistakes and it really comes down to experience because no one would teach you these stuff. But you learn these things through conversations like this. Like I hope someone hears this podcast and say, oh crap, I need to go check on my colors. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Building Blocks podcast. Today, I'm super excited to have a good friend and a fellow founder, Aishwarya Iyer, who is the founder and CEO of Brightland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jason. I'm super excited to be here.
I've been trying to get you to come out to hang out for a while now, and our first time is going to be on the podcast show. So I'll take it that the show is cooler, and I'll take it.
Well, I can't wait to hang IRL too, but I'm super excited for this conversation and I love your podcast. So
Thank you. So I've been following Brightland for a while now because your packaging, your bottle is just absolutely beautiful. It's like, do you ever see people using it as like a interior decor, like a decor piece?
All the time, actually.
Was that the intention?
A little bit. I said, if that becomes a happy coincidence out of this, then I'll be thrilled. But to then see it manifest itself in like thousands of people, you know, tens of thousands of people, like using them as vases, using them like some people use them in their like jewelry situation, like bangle holders.
What?
Like, we've seen all kinds of use cases. A lot of people use the bottles as candle holders.
Wow.
I know, it's really wild. So I could have never imagined the sort of the creativity of it all, but I'm here for it.
Yeah, it's kind of like a byproduct of just your branding and people are like, I could see second uses out of it. The surprising thing that I had at Doe at my last company was our packaging became collectibles. Like, because we released limited edition packaging. And so we have some customers who have 80 pairs of lashes.
Wow.
And like they have an entire drawer of it. And it's just for the past 4 years, all the different packaging that we had. And there's like trading going on. Like this is like weird because sometimes we only do like limited release of 500 units. So it becomes really rare.
Right.
And I never thought of it that way. I just want to make pretty packaging.
Right. But I mean, that speaks to the power of what you built, right? Like we have an artist series of infused oils, like our chili olive oil. You know, we have this artist, Marley Culver, who created the label for it. So we have four or five of those now. And we have customers who've told us the same thing. Like, they're just basically collecting every single
one. I love that.
It's so special. It's amazing.
Because no one really think about the olive oil that they buy. They walk into a store, they pick it out, and they're like, it's cooking oil.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more thought and intentions behind buying your products, at least from what I'm hearing. And I love that. That never happened before with olive oil.
No, it didn't. And I saw that because I noticed that, you know, there are categories that have both product affinity and brand affinity. Like if, you know, you ask about like beauty lipstick, for example, yeah. Someone will be like, oh my God, they'll talk about lipstick for 20 minutes and then they'll tell you that Chanel or MAC or whatever is their favorite brand. A plunger, nobody wants to talk about it, nor do they care about what the brand is. And then with olive oil, it was very interesting because everyone would be like, oh my God, I love olive oil. And then they would like start just talking about it and how they use it. And I was always like, great. So what brand are you using? Like what's at home? And that's when it stopped. And people were like,
oh, I just pick it off the shelf, the one that says extra virgin olive oil. I don't even know what extra virgin means, but I'm just going to get that. Like they don't think about it.
You don't. That's right.
You started Brightland in 2018, and previously you're in PR and communications. Yes. And from what I'm seeing, a lot of what you did back in PR and communications translated into how you built Brightland, and in particular, storytelling, which is a crucial part of making yourself stand out. amongst a very saturated category. I'd love to hear about what your thought process were when you were building Brightland and how to tell that story.
Gosh, I mean, I think like I went in, I was very naive, you know what I mean? And I think that's, at the end of the day, I think that's healthy to have a lot of naivete, because if I had known what I know now, I'm not sure I would even be doing this. Like, because it's a lot harder than what I thought it would end up becoming. But I just, like, to your point, you know, my background was in corporate communications and PR and public affairs. So I said, you know what, let me lean into what I think I'm good at. Like, I wasn't a digital ad savant. I wasn't some sort of, you know, crazy like growth hacking marketing person, but I knew how to tell a pretty good story. So I said, okay, you know, we bootstrapped for the first year plus. So we definitely didn't have some sort of like big venture sort of investment, like money to play around with. So I said, okay, with the limited resources we have, let me at least, you know, maybe bring on like a PR consultant to help us with our launch, who's in food. Cause at least, you know, I understood the potential power of that. And yeah. So that's how we really laid the groundwork for the brand. It was very much rooted in other people telling our story and seeding the product to like sort of the right people. Cause I also didn't have a background in food to top this off. So, you know, I wasn't like, I'm not a chef. I'm not some like, you know, food influencer. And so the authority around like, hey, I'm coming out with this like brand and this product, I felt like I didn't have that. And in order to turn that on its head a little bit, it felt like, you know, at least being really true to the story and telling people like why I started it and, you know, letting other people tell that story too, in terms of like journalists and stuff, that really helped move the needle.
Your approach when you started was very different than what most brands would do. Like, PR was never the first thing that people go after. It's usually like branding or paid advertising or influencers. But for you, because you knew PR well, you knew the impact it would drive and it worked well in your favor, which kind of just becomes a testament that there's no right formula to building your business. There's no like sequence that you have to follow in order to be successful. And rather, I would say like, because you start in PR and you laid a first brick with storytelling and brand positioning, that it made you stand out immediately. You're not just another olive oil, you are Brightland.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. I totally agree with you. Like, you know, we have, I'm sure you get this too, where you have like aspiring entrepreneurs or people who are in the early stages who say, hey, you know, I would love to sort of like, tell me what you did. I'd love to kind of like use that as a playbook. And I always tell people like, it depends on what your product is. It depends on what your own story is. It depends on what your superpower is. And then ultimately it's also like the time that we live in. I don't know if what I did in, you know, at the end of 2018 would now work in 2022. Like I still think content and storytelling is key, but the form and format that you do it in, I think has totally changed.
Oh yeah. The medium has changed, but the concept is still strong and alive.
Right.
I was just telling people like content is king, but the content that you knew 6 years ago is not the same as right now in terms of like impact.
Yes.
People want shorter bites. They want quick punches and yes. You know, it's fair because there's just more content flowing around. And even for like PR, I would say you can't just write an article just to write an article. You really need to like understand what's compelling about the story and piece it up into different formats that people can consume now. Like one single article won't really lift it for you anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And for us, you know, the day that we launched, we were featured by the New York Times style section. And that was that like one piece that like at least helped us catapult, you know,
yeah.
It put us on the map and it catapulted us. And now, you know, I've heard of brands telling me that like they got that same placement, you know, upon launch or pretty quickly afterwards. And it, of course, it like moves the needle. It's the New York Times. It moves the needle, but I don't think it moves the needle in the way that it did even 3 years ago.
Yeah. Just the impact of media or if like someone's that big,
all shifted.
Kind of went down a little bit. I'm assuming that you didn't come from supply chain. Like your background was not in supply chain. Well, walk me through the first step of like sourcing like the oil that you want, sourcing the bottle that you want, because it's all news to you back then, right?
It was all so new to me. And I definitely underestimated the complexity of it all. Like, I thought it would be, I underestimated and overestimated. You know what I mean? Like, I went into it being like, wow, this is very overwhelming. There's so many facets of this that, you know, I have no past experience with, and like, you know, it's way over my head. And then I also underestimated the sheer sort of amount of attention to detail that's required. I remember looking at your stories recently, and you were talking about like four different shades of pink that mm-hmm. you needed to choose from that all looked the same that one yeah. of your suppliers had sent you. Yeah. yeah. Something like that, where like that decision though is very crucial, and it would be easy to like look at it on a screen and make the call, and then you get the actual sample and you're like, this looks nothing like what I, you know? Yeah. And so we yeah. just made, I made so many mistakes, time and again. But coming back to the sourcing of the oil, that was one area that I was, you know, the product has to speak for itself. Like, that's our product, right? So we, I took classes at the UC Davis Olive Center to really like get educated
Whoa,
around.
Really?
Yeah. Cause I wanted to get educated around like the sensory evaluation and the chemical kind of analysis of what good olive oil truly is. Right. So that set at least a little bit of a foundation. And I read a ton. I read, you know, at least 5-6 books about olive oil. So all of that just at least put me in a place where I wasn't like, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And then I started visiting, you know, farmers in California, and, you know, a lot of them wouldn't give me the time of day, but then a few people did. And, I had 40 different people come to my house and try different olive oils from different farms, plus conventional grocery store brands, and do rankings. And then ultimately the farm that ended up kind of going to the highest ranking was the farm we ended up partnering with, and we still work with them.
I love that. Like, you went straight to the source. You talked to the people who are, you know, growing your olives. And
oh, yeah. It's all direct source. Yeah, I want to point that out. Like, that's really, really important. That's part of our values, is that we only direct source. Whether it's our honey, whether it's our vinegar, whether it's our olive oil, we directly interact with the farmers. We know exactly who they are, where it's made, how it's made. We know that within 90 minutes, for example, that the olives are pressed and milled. Like, these are all really important factors that a lot of people don't have that kind of I think, visibility into in yeah. food. And a lot of food brands don't know. And so we're really proud of that. And yeah, it's been a really, like, I think, amazing ride on that end. All but kind of came with, on the bottle and label and all of that front, oh my yeah. God, Jason, like, so many, I made so many mistakes.
Tell me, I'm curious. I'll tell you mine.
Well, tell me one, and then I'll tell you.
There's a few. I think packaging is one of those things where you look at the dial line, you see it visually, and yeah. you're like, yeah, it works. Without understanding that when you start expanding your product catalog, you need to make sure that all the packaging are cohesive and they're, you know, they're the same, or like the sizing matters, because that also affects how you ship stuff. I didn't think about that far. I'm just like, it's a pretty packaging. It looks good here. I didn't think 10 steps ahead. When it, as a founder, you have to think 10 steps ahead. How does this packaging affect shipping capability? Does this withstand transit? We had a packaging that was in the shape of a milk carton, because that's kind of like our branding. It's like the cutesy, cartoony stuff. And it came in like a milk carton, which is great. And then it just splits apart during transit. So people will receive their packaging opened. Like, you don't think about that far when you're making the packaging. But now I'm like, I kind of run through simulations in my head. If I make this packaging, if I make this product, how does it look like when we're packing it, when we're shipping it, and when the customer receive it? Like, you have to think that through. Color matching is a second thing. Oh my God. I'm not sure if you have like a Pantone book, but we recently bought a Pantone book out of necessity, because every single batch was a different shade of pink.
Oh, we've gone through that.
Yeah. And I didn't realize it until people put it side by side and said, hey, it's like off. I'm like, no, there's no way it's off. It's always the same. No, like, suppliers don't care that much. So you kind of have to be on their toes for it. But yeah, no, there's a number of mistakes, and it really comes down to experience, because no one will teach you these yeah. stuff.
No.
Unless you're going to like a very specialized mentorship school where they tell you their mistakes, but you learn these things through conversations like this. Like, yes. I hope someone hears this podcast and say, oh crap, I need to go check on my colors.
I 1000% agree with you. I don't think a single business school or, I don't think anything can prepare you for this unless you've worked at another early stage startup, like one of your team members or one of my team members watching these mistakes, and then they then go and start their own kind of, you know, product-based company. Maybe they'll then like have the lessons that they've learned, or people listening to this podcast. And yeah, and like we had the Pantone situation has been a big saga for us too. Like our labels, our packaging, there's different shades of blue. And we also have so many colors as our brand colors. Yeah. Like we have a tomato, a marigold, a blueberry, a light pink, a violet. Like we have a lot going on. And I love that because the brand is very colorful and bright because it's Brightland. But we also have like 10 shades of that tomato. And so we had to narrow, we spent months narrowing down and nailing down what those colors actually are and going back to every supplier and making sure that like it all ends up looking cohesive. So shout out to my VP of product development and strategy because she really took that on and it was a beast of a project. But at the very beginning of our launch, like the 2 weeks before that New York Times piece came out, I was talking to our Olive Farm partner and they were like, so your labels and your bottle don't work together because we never tested it. And I went ahead and I had ordered, you know, the 1,000 whatever of the bottles and the label without ever testing. And so it was time for them to do the run. And they were like, we've been trying for the last 10 hours to affix the label onto your bottle. And what keeps happening is it either like, it sticks on, but it's all crumpled up. The label looks like it's all wrinkled on the bottle and it's not able to be smooth. And such a disaster.
That's scary.
It is so scary. And so that first run, like all those customers who bought, when they read the New York Times article, some of them got, I sent handwritten notes to every single one of them saying, I'm so sorry that your label looks a little bit wonky. And what's crazy though is some of those customers are still customers to this day. Like they've kind of come along with us. So I'm very grateful on that side, but the lessons learned are, it's like gnarly.
You know, the cool thing about DTC business is that it's actually direct to consumer. You could write a handwritten note to your customer and let them know transparently what's happening. You could be authentic. You could tell your story of, hey, we made a little mistake. Hope you still like us. And that makes them like you even more because what other olive oil brand that they bought from would write them a letter? Yeah, what company would admit their mistake instead of saying, oh, that's just how it is. And I think like just being authentic and being vulnerable and letting your customers know that, hey, we're building something that I think you'll like, but there's got to be a little bumps into it, will make them even more loyal customer than if you just, you know, even try to like perfectly affix a sticker. Even if the stickers came perfectly fine at first batch, the people that got your handwritten note and saw the little mistake is a lot more attached to you than someone who would have gotten a perfect bottle.
I think you're right.
You know, looking back, you could say that, but like in the moment, it's obviously very scary. Like I get it. Like there are times when I'm like manually fixing every single piece of stuff. Yeah. Or sometimes like for our lashes, it's affixed to a little tray. So sometimes the glue gets, you know, a little wonky and the lashes fall. Like I'm piecing everything, these things together. But that's just part of the business that you look back on and be like, okay, we've grown a lot from that and it's good. Like once you hit that low, it all goes up from here. I like to look at it that way.
I think that's a fabulous way of looking at it. And yeah, we can look back and like laugh at these things. But I completely agree with you on it.
I wanted to ask you one last question, which is the fact that Brightland has been praised by so many people and called a cult favorite, which is a very hard badge of honor to have a cult favorite. There's not many things I can think of and be like, that's a cult favorite. But you obviously have a very loyal audience. And I want to hear about what are some of the things that you have done to have that audience and making sure that you're engaging with them and, you know, getting them to like you and come back again.
It's such a good question. I mean, I am really hard on myself and I think like just like hard on the business in that way. Like, I don't think what we do is enough at all. So, you know, the minute you like, I knew what you were asking, and I immediately went into like, my brain went into panic mode of like, we're not doing anything. Like, what is it? But I will say, I mean, I think even the example that I shared of like that handwritten note, we've had other instances where, you know, we had to change all of our idols in the middle of the year because of sort of like, at the end of the day, these are products of agriculture. And I had to send, you know, notes to our customers about that. I think really being like forthcoming and sort of like, taking them along for the ride as much as we can. I think, showing that at the end of the day, we're all really human. So, you know, our customer experience associate, she used to work at 11 Madison Park as a SOM. So like wine and hospitality are just such big parts of her sort of way of being. And so when she interacts with our customers, she puts that hat on and really like takes them through like a tasting journey. I think that that helps. I think each piece of it, like, you know, we are not the business that has like a special Facebook group. Like, we don't have anything like that that kind of brings our customers together in that way. We've talked about it, but we've never really done it. But I think that our customers sort of feel like they're entering a little bit of a special world when they shop with us. And I don't know, this isn't a great answer, but I don't know why. It was what I wanted when Brightland launched. And then to hear them say that has been really validating. But I think I'm even lacking the like understanding of why they exactly feel that way. I'm very honored by it, but I don't know what it is.
I feel like I kind of have an idea. And you say you don't because you're harsh on yourself, but like everything you told me gave me like snippets of like why people like you guys so much. The dedication to the supply chain, it's phenomenal, because I cannot go and buy olive oil off the shelf and know that this brand went directly to the roots, to the farmer, to source that. Like, okay, I now know that something that I'm buying is pure, something that has heart pour into it. That makes me emotionally invested. Cult following usually comes when people have some sort of a emotional investment into your company. And that's usually coming through a few forms. One is they feel like they are a part of your journey and they share in your failures and successes. They saw when you made a mistake and you talked to them about it. They saw the success that you had when you got on the news, when you are posting all these social content showing behind the scenes. Like, they feel like, oh crap, I can see through the glass of how this business is run. So they are more invested in your success. And looking into like the brands that you absolutely love and anything, you kind of felt the same way, right? Like, you either know the founder, you heard their story, they have a very compelling story that they told, or, you know, that you know that their supply chain is pure. You know that they are working hard because you've seen videos of their team working together. Like, that's what drives the specialty and uniqueness of a DTC brand compared to something that was never built in DTC. The communication,
and has soul. Right? I think that's it too. Yeah, I think you nailed. You said the word soul, and I think that that's like, that's the really special word here too. Absolutely. To be able to show that you have more than just like nice packaging and a good website.
Absolutely. So, final question in 60 seconds. Tell me, what was that one advice you'll give to yourself in 2018 if you had to do it all over again?
Whew. Okay. If I had to do it all over again, the advice that I would give myself is, I mean, honestly, it comes back to what we talked about in the beginning. Like, I don't think I would say much, because I think it was best that I didn't know as much as I know now, because otherwise I would have never done it. This was the best thing that I ever could have done for myself as a person to grow and evolve. And I will look back on this if I live to be, you know, 70 and be really, I think I'll be in awe of like my ability to be resilient and move forward, but I wouldn't want that person from 2018 to know what was coming and what was ahead. So I would probably, the one piece of advice I would say that I would probably go back to that person is like, just try to like take more pictures of kind of documenting. And like, if you even have the bandwidth to write like one line of how you're feeling, even for yourself, like not to document it to the world, but just like articulate your sort of ups and downs in that roller coaster and like kind of encapsulate that if you can somewhere and keep it. I think I would probably go back and do that because I didn't do that, and I wish I did, actually.
That's a wonderful advice. I actually document everything.
Wow.
I have a picture of me packing orders in a foldable table in my living room.
Oh, amazing.
And it's good to look back. Like, you want to look back at these things and say, I grew. And you know, perfect advice. I think that's really good advice. And I love the fact that you said that it's good that you didn't know anything, because the mistakes that you make grew you into the person that you are right now. And if you're happy with where you're at, those mistakes contributed to how you got here.
That's exactly it. I always tell other aspiring entrepreneurs, like, don't dive too much into it all to try to figure it all out. Like, know that, you know, it's going to hit you in 10 different ways, and that's totally okay. And, like, just know that the thing you do want to, like, practice is the ability to get back up again and keep going. Like, that's the only thing.
Absolutely. It's all about shifting your mindset.
That's it.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. This was really fun. Just chatting through your story, finally getting to talk to you. Hopefully we'll meet in real life soon.
Yes,
and hopefully I will get your olive oil soon, because I'm about to place an order. It's on the other screen right now.
Yahoo!
And I'll let you know. I'll definitely use it as a decor. I've been looking for a perfect decor for my home.
Perfect. Amazing. Thank you so much for having me, Jason.
You just heard an episode of the Building Blocks podcast. If you like what you heard, subscribe below to keep hearing conversations that I have with brilliant marketers, founders, and innovators on how they built their best ideas. Now, if you want to learn how you can turn your best ideas and build something massive out of it, visit my website, bbclass.co, or follow my Twitter @agro.